You're listening to Community Radio, CKMS Radio Waterloo, 102.7, 946 on the Rogers Digital Network.
Good morning, Waterloo Region, and happy Krishnak Diwali Eid to you all. It's the Christmas season. You're listening to CKMS Community Connections. My name is Bob Jonkman. Today we're interviewing Jen Hutton from the Women's Crisis Services of Waterloo Region. And we'll be playing some local Christmas music by local musicians. This is Taylor Davison, her new single called Christmas Changes.
Gift exchanges, then suddenly Christmas changes. We used to sit around the tree, the five of us, a family, singing songs like prayers on Christmas Eve. But now we've got other places to be, obligations and responsibilities.
Changes by Taylor Davison, who joins us in the studio next week for our last live in studio episode of the year. That'll be something to look forward to. On the phone, I have Jen Hutton from the Women's Crisis Services of Waterloo Region. Good morning, Jen. Welcome to CKMS Community Connections.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. I suppose I should start off by telling folks how I came across Women's Crisis Services. I was looking for some locally produced podcasts in locally produced the Waterloo region, and happened to come across the WR Dashboard, which is a great resource for all kinds of stuff online. And there you were listed. The She Is Your Neighbor podcast that you've been producing for, what, about 5 or 6 months now?
Yeah, we started in September of this year.
Yeah, so that's not that long at all, actually.
No.
So caught you right at the beginning of the cycle there. You've got the occasional podcast airing on our WR Podcasts feature, which airs on Friday mornings at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. But tell me about Women's Crisis Services, Waterloo Region.
Sure. So Women's Crisis Services of Waterloo Region, we're probably best known for our two shelters. We have Ansama House in Kitchener, and we have Haven House in Cambridge. Each of our shelters has 45 beds each, so 90 beds altogether. We are one of the larger violence against women shelters in the province. At about any one time, almost half of our residents are children, and they tend to be younger children. We also have outreach services because we know not every woman necessarily needs to come into shelter, but women can meet with our outreach workers and learn a little bit about their risk, do some safety planning, get connected to community resources, all that type of thing. And we see about over 1,000 women through that program. We also run a youth education program and are connected to different community groups to offer that program. We have a number of services both in shelter and out of shelter. We do music therapy. We have a psychologist that works with us that we refer to, Dr. Kathy. She's amazing. So we have all sorts of different programs that we offer.
You said that WCS is one of the largest women's shelters in Ontario. Is that because there's a greater need for it here in Waterloo Region, or is it because we're just more well endowed with good fortune?
Well, I think it's maybe a bit of both. We know that domestic violence is actually it's very prevalent. It's a global problem, but it's also a problem in our community. As great of a community as we have in Waterloo Region. We know police get about 6,000 domestic violence service calls a year. So that's a call every 90 minutes. So that speaks to the extent of the problem. And we know that a lot of women don't call the police. So that number is even just the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. So we have big shelters because there is a need. Our shelters are almost always full. Plus, we also have had the good fortune of a community that's very supportive, and our shelters are relatively new. And Sama House is probably about 11-12 years old. Haven House is about going to be 4 years old. So we have very nice shelters and very large shelter, both because of the need and also because of the community support.
Yeah, of those 6,000 calls you said,
yeah,
are a lot of those repeat calls, the same people calling multiple times?
They can be. I'm not sure exactly the stats on what police would have as recidivism rates, but unfortunately, that is sort of the nature of the problem. We know statistically it takes women on average about 14 times to leave an abusive relationship before they leave for good. We know that not everybody needs to necessarily leave an abusive relationship, nor do they want to. Our main goal is that women or kids are safe, and we want to give them as many tools to make sure that they're safe. But sometimes women definitely do need to leave, and sometimes they need shelter, so we want to be there for them with what they need.
So when women finally do decide to leave, actually, what would make them stay? Is it an economic consideration? People who have women who have no means of support other than an abusive spouse?
Yeah, that can be a big part. We know a lot of the women that we work with, a high percentage of them are also dealing with financial abuse. So they may have no access to funds. So that can definitely keep them in not a great situation because they just don't even know how to do it. But really that's even one of the factors. There is so many factors. I think one of the big myths or misconceptions that people will say is, why would a woman stay? And I think we need to shift that narrative to, you know, why are men abusive? Yeah. But also just recognizing that there is so many reasons why women do stay, and that how challenging, if they did want to leave, how challenging that is. There's just so many barriers to doing that. Children, safety, economic reasons. The list is really endless.
So let's get something out of the way right now. How do people get a hold of you? Somebody wants to leave right now. What should they do?
Yeah, what they can do is just pick up the phone if it's safe for them to make a call. And we have a 24/7 support line. And who they will get on the other end of that is one of our trained staff. So they can make a plan with them. I always say... you know, whenever I'm talking to anybody from the media or within the community, that women have to be aware that when they leave, if they're in an abusive relationship, that is the absolute highest risk time for them. So they really should get some help around making a safety plan. That's really important. So again, they can call our 24/7 support lines. Or the other thing, because we know during the pandemic, it can be a little bit more tricky for women to have that time where they're alone that they can pick up the phone. So we actually created an online chat feature. So sometimes that might be a bit more of a discreet way that a woman could do it through her cell phone or laptop, where all she has to do is pull up our website, and then she can start chatting with one of our staff through that function.
And that number that they should call is...
Let me just grab it here.
I've got it in front of me here. It's 519-742-5894. This is for people who are experiencing abuse in Kitchener-Waterloo and want to leave or need some counseling. Call 519-742-5894. In Cambridge, 519-653-2422.
And I would just add that women can call. It doesn't matter where, if you're in Kitchener, if you're in Cambridge, if you're in one of the outlying rural areas of Waterloo Region, it doesn't really matter what number. If you need to call, please call. They'll make sure you get routed to the person that you need to talk to, and that's 24/7.
Yeah, and of course, if you're in immediate danger, call 911.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So with this number of people in Waterloo Region seeking shelter, are you meeting capacity? Are you meeting the need? Or could you use still more resources in the area?
Well, we can always use more resources, unfortunately. Like I had mentioned at the start, we're pretty much full every day of the week, as we have been lately. It was a little bit odd for us, and I know, you know, ideally we would like to not have to have these large shelters. But at the start of the pandemic, I think it was tricky for women to reach out, or they were not making the decision to leave abusive relationships. There was so much uncertainty as to, you know, what was going to happen in the future that we actually saw our numbers decrease. But as things have opened up, prior to the second wave, then we got back up to what would be typical for us, which is full shelters. In terms of resources, we're really focused. We feel like we have the large shelters that we need. You know, we know a struggle is affordable housing. So that's always something that we're looking at, and trying to move women out of shelter into affordable housing, which can be challenging at times. As we know, in our community, there is an affordable housing crisis. And our shelters are emergency stay shelters, so they're meant to be more short-term than what they can sometimes be. But we're also really putting our minds to, how do we prevent domestic violence from even happening? So how do we reach children? How do we do more youth education? All those things are also where we're putting our efforts, so that we don't have to keep building larger shelters.
Right. I think that somebody once told me that, you know, everything is a political problem. Here we have a women's crisis problem, a women's abuse problem, an abuse problem in general. And if you're not part of the political solution to women's crisis, then you're part of the women's crisis problem, is what he said. Mm-hmm. So I can see that having some political action taking place, you know, implementing a basic income, for example, so women have security, financial security, and having housing available, readily affordable housing available, those things would go a long way to protecting women if they need to get away.
Yeah.
But absolutely. As you say, it doesn't actually solve the root problem.
No, it doesn't. And you know, we can have probably very long conversations around the root problem, and that we have a long way to go. We know that even though we do have a long way to go, what has given me some hope during this time, time of pandemic, has really been the amount of growing awareness as to the problem of domestic violence. I think more and more people are realizing that when people are being asked to stay at home, that home may not be safe for a lot of people. So I think, and we've seen more coverage in the media about domestic violence, so that growing awareness and that sense of responsibility that people are seeming to feel is giving me hope around, you know, awareness is always a start for tackling a really difficult problem.
Yeah. It's been reported in the media. You just said that with the COVID pandemic being present, you've actually seen a decrease in the demand for your services. Yet I've heard the opposite from the media, that because of the pandemic and people being forced to stay at home, there's actually an increase in domestic violence.
Oh, yeah, and that's the interesting thing. I think very much there has been an increase in domestic violence. When you add in a pandemic, we know that domestic violence rates tend to go up. When there's pandemics, when there's natural disasters, the research has shown that. You add in uncertainty, a situation that people can't control. The pandemic itself can be used to further isolate as part of that pattern of abuse and power and control. So economic stressors, that's another huge factor. You add in all those things, domestic violence rates have gone up. It's just at the start of the pandemic, it wasn't even safe for women to reach out for help. Because oftentimes when women are calling us, they're maybe calling us, and they're doing this for their own safety, is they're calling us when their abusive partner is at work or out to the store or whenever they have that free, safe moment to do so. They weren't having those opportunities, so they weren't even reaching out for help. Yet we knew that abuse was still happening, and yet that it was worsening.
Yeah.
So we have, and then, unfortunately, when we see the women come into shelter, some of the stories that we're hearing was of more severe type of abuse.
So I'm thinking, when I think of abuse, I think of physical abuse, but you've mentioned economic or financial abuse.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are other ways that women are oppressed, abused in the home.
Yeah, absolutely. Emotional, psychological abuse, that's very much at the core of a lot of what we're seeing. And sometimes that is emotional, psychological abuse, and you know, never to diminish that. That leaves, you know, emotional scars that don't repair. And then other times it can escalate into physical abuse. And then there's all sorts of other abuse. But it's a very complicated topic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the different stories that we hear are as unique and individual as the people that we support.
I just want to make sure that women realize that it doesn't necessarily have to be physical abuse, being beaten up, that you can help with. You could help with forced social isolation, you know, not being allowed to see your friends any longer, or not being allowed to go out and do the grocery shopping because you're not trusted with the money. All those things are abuse, and you can help with all of those.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the actual process of going through and, you know, from the time that somebody calls you to request support, how the process works, how they actually get the shelter, and mm-hmm. what happens when, you know, once they're in the shelter, where do they go from there?
Yeah,
sure. I'd like to take a little bit of a break first. My brain is kind of full at the moment. I'd like to play a Christmas song by Eye the Mountain. Eye the Mountain is a local band, and they've got all their friends together to sing a Christmas song, All I Want for Christmas Is You.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need.
I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree.
I just want you for my own, more than you could ever know.
Make my wish come true, all I want for Christmas
is you.
So brightly everywhere, children waiting for sleigh rides, making angels looking for reindeer as they play outside, and their laughter fills the air. And everyone is fa-hoo-far-is-da-hoo-dar-is singing. In the distance, I hear those sleigh bells ringing. Santa, you know I've been nice. Bring me my baby, don't make me ask twice. The one that I need, please. Kris Kringle, won't you bring my baby to me? Yeah.
Thank you.
the Mountain.
Their new video, All I Want for Christmas, with all manner of guests from local Waterloo region. Have a look at the YouTube video and see if you can recognize some of the guests that are playing on that. I have on the phone Jen Hutton from the Women's Crisis Services of Waterloo Region. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning.
You're talking about getting shelter by calling the help number, the 24-hour crisis number, 519-742-5894, if you live in Kitchener-Waterloo. If you need help from domestic abuse, that's the number to call. What happens when somebody calls that number?
Well, when somebody gives us a call, we have one of our residential staff that would answer that phone line. They answer it all through the night, you know, holidays. It's 24/7, 365 days a year. And what we do at that point is really see what the caller is wanting. They are the ones to guide the process, and we really take our cue from them. So we get all sorts of calls. We may have somebody call that maybe they just want to talk and want a little bit of a listening ear or some advice. We even have sometimes friends or family members call and maybe say, hey, I'm worried about an aunt, a sister, friend, whoever that may be. Could you give me some suggestions on how I might be able to help them? So, and I really appreciate when those calls come in, because I think sometimes people feel they're worried about a loved one and they feel a bit powerless as to what to do. So we can help in that regard. If a woman's calling us, then what we would do is find out a bit more about her situation and really go through her risk. We have a set questions that are asked to help assess what her risk level may be. And those questions are really important, because sometimes they really stimulate a light bulb moment for a person, where they might say, oh, really, that's a risk factor. And we can explain a bit more as to that. And we're really trying to see what they might need. Some women maybe want to get out of the situation. They want to get out of the situation as soon as possible, and they might not have other friends or family to stay with. So we would help them make a safe exit plan. And like I had mentioned earlier when we had spoke, it's so important to get some guidance around that, because oftentimes that is the highest risk time when a woman is leaving. So we want to run through some things that she may need to consider, stuff around her children and their safety, making sure that she's bringing important documents, that she has a bag packed and ready to go, but hidden, that she has her birth certificate, that she has the documents that she needs for her children. And we could make arrangements, again, for a safe time for her to leave. And we can do that, sending a taxi or whatever that might be to get her to shelter. Or if maybe, say, it's a woman who doesn't necessarily know, or maybe doesn't even want to leave an abusive relationship, but wants to know how it might be a bit better, how she might be a bit safer, how she could help her kids. And then in those circumstances, then she might get booked to meet with one of our outreach workers. And the nice thing with our outreach workers is that they're able to respond quite quickly. So a referral gets made to them, and we don't have a wait list. And they are able to connect with her right away. Of course, during the pandemic, that looks a little bit different and is dependent sort of where we are as a community in terms of zones and that kind of thing. In the summer, when things let up, and it was nice that we actually had our outreach workers, some of them were carrying around lawn chairs in their trunk, and would sit down and meet with a woman if it was safe in her yard or in her driveway, because we know that nothing beats seeing somebody face to face. But for now, we're doing a lot of phone and virtual calls. So outreach is very flexible. They can respond quite quickly. And sometimes over time, an outreach worker meets with a woman and she may decide, you know what, that's all I need for now. I just needed, you know, some safety planning or some referrals. Or she might say, you know what, I really need to leave. It's worsened, and can you help me get to shelter? and then that outreach worker can help the person get into shelter in a safe way. And then on the other hand, some women come straight into shelter with us and spend some time with us in shelter, and then they might be moving on to independence and going back out to the community, but on their own this time. So we can also refer them to an outreach worker to meet with them in their new place, make sure that their new place is set up, that they're getting accustomed to their new community and they have things in place, and that they know about the safety of their new house and all those kinds of things. So it's a very versatile, very flexible and accessible program, and that's the way it needs to be.
So when somebody comes into the shelter, generally they'll bring their kids along.
Yes.
What does a shelter look like? Is it a dormitory style, people sharing rooms, or are
there? No, it's not. And during COVID, that is something I'm extremely grateful for. I had mentioned that we have fairly new shelters. Our oldest shelter in Selma House is only about 11, 12 years old. And the way that it was built is more like a hotel style. So everybody has individual rooms and bathrooms. And then for the larger families, it's one room that adjoins into another room. So it's quite user-friendly that way. And it's really saved us during COVID, because we know the spread of the virus, that you want to avoid communal areas and communal washrooms and all those things. So we were in a good situation right from the get-go because of the individual bedrooms and bathrooms.
Still shared dining?
Yep, we do have communal dining, but we have very large shelters. So we, you know, we have had to use tape and all those things to make sure we have appropriate distance, and people kind of cohort in their families for meal times. You know, when women first come into shelter, there is more of a quarantine time period. So it's, you know, not the full group that's necessarily out in the communal area, but that's, we're lucky that we just have a very big open space and we can allow for the distancing that we need.
So women who are in the shelter, do they continue to work if they have jobs? Do they?
So. Absolutely. And kids still go to school for the most part. As much as we can, kids go back to their same school. And we have arrangements with both school boards to get them there, whether that's busing, whether that's cabs. But we try to keep things, you know, as much normal and stable as we can for kids, even though that's very tricky because they've just gone through a very traumatic time and they're in shelter. But school for them is often a place where their friends are and their teachers know them. So it's important to keep them in their usual school as much as we can.
School is generally a safe place for kids coming from an abusive family.
Yeah, for sure.
And people stay at the shelter for a week?
No, it's actually quite a bit longer than that. Our average length of stay would be about 8 weeks. And again, that really depends on the availability of housing. So we have seen those wait times creep up a bit because there's less affordable housing. But women are typically with us until transitioning into affordable housing, often independently, if that's what they've chosen to do. So, you know, sometimes those 8 weeks become 12, 13 weeks, 14 weeks, depending on that availability of housing.
Right. How do women achieve independence? They've got no furniture, they've got no belongings. I'm imagining that someone who leaves an abusive relationship does so in a terrible hurry without spending time to pack up the furniture and the belongings.
Yeah, that can often be the way. And we're lucky we have a lot of community partners. It's definitely work that can't be done in isolation at all. We rely very much on our community partners to help women get set up, and you know, everything from having partnerships with thrift stores where they give us coupons so that women can go and get the stuff that they need, You know, we work closely with the food bank. We have all sorts of different partnerships that help women set up a home if they're moving into independence. So we really have to draw on all those different partnerships that we have to get a woman set up the way that she would need to be set up.
So once a woman and her family have left the safety of Anselma House and they're out on their own, that's it? That's the last interaction they have? Or do you continue?
No, definitely not.
Leading question.
Yeah. That's outreach. Often they would be given outreach referrals whenever they're leaving shelter so that they can have help transitioning. We know that that's a big change for them, and they may not be accustomed to their neighborhood or their community centers that are attached to neighborhoods. They need to consider safety planning for their new home. You know, if they're in an apartment, making sure doors are secure, all those things they get help with from outreach. So sometimes outreach is helping them get into shelter, and sometimes outreach is for the first time helping them as they're leaving shelter.
Right. And now people are out there and are independent. Do people come back if there is, you know, additional violence? If the husband, for example, were to come and hunt them down, is their retreat possible?
Absolutely. It's very important that our services are flexible and responsive, because unfortunately, we know that can be a reality, that a woman may leave an abuse situation, but they may be dealing with stalking. There may be ongoing safety threats, and then they may need to come into shelter at that time. We've also helped women relocate because it just wasn't safe for them to continue living in the community. So I can think of a couple women that, one in particular that had some family out east. So she relocated out of the province because that was the best thing for her to do in terms of having supports available and for being the most safe.
Is there a network of crisis services across Ontario, across Canada?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's shelter services all for women all through Canada. We have a region that we work with quite frequently. I'm regularly in touch, whether it's Guelph shelters, shelters in Halton, Peel. So we work really closely and learn from each other and help each other. And we have a partnership with other shelters that say, for whatever reason, if we were full, if we were at capacity, then our crisis workers would be calling around to the other shelters, and sometimes a woman may need to go and stay at a shelter, say in Guelph, because they have beds available, and then when our bed is available, then we would bring them back. Okay. But we really kind of rely on each other and help each other out in that regard, for sure.
Yeah, I was wondering what happens when you're full up, but mm-hmm. that sounds like it's good cooperation between all the different services across the area.
Yeah, very much so.
I'd like to move into the podcast at some point, but I think we need some more Christmas music first.
Okay.
How about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? This done by Astrocolor from Victoria, BC. Not the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer that you might know.
Rudolph of the 21st century. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the soft tone remix by Astrocolor from Victoria, BC. You're listening to CKMS Community Connections. My name is Bob Jonkman. I have on the phone Jen Hutton from the Women's Crisis Services of Waterloo Region. Hello, Jen.
Hello.
You have some 21st century happenings at the Women's Crisis Services as well. You've started a podcast.
Yeah, we have.
You did this in September?
Yes. Yep. September was the first time. We had originally did a She Is Your Neighbor project the prior year in 2019, and we did a blog series, and that went over quite well. And I think raised quite a bit of awareness. So we took it up a notch and we did a podcast series that came out, I believe it was sort of mid to the end of September.
Yeah. And you're releasing a new episode weekly. I mean, that's an incredible pace.
Yeah, it is. And it's pretty amazing when you think about the staff resources that we have to do this, which is, you know, a little bit limited. But we have some incredibly talented staff, and Jenna, who you had connected with earlier, is our communications and fund development manager, and she came with a bit of broadcasting experience. So This podcast is really her brainchild, and she does a fantastic job, and literally this is not even done in a studio, but she has a little mic, and away she goes, and the end product's been pretty impressive.
It has been, yeah. We've been playing it on occasion on our Friday WR Podcasts showcase. And it's well produced. It's good, high quality, and A fascinating topic. What sort of people have you had as guests on the podcast?
Oh, we've had a variety of different guests. I think there's about 10 episodes. We've had everybody from Brenda Holleran, who is Waterloo mayor for two terms, mm-hmm. and she shares her story. She's a survivor herself. We have had Lori Campbell speak about Indigenous women and girls and the rate that they experience domestic violence and all the missing and murdered Indigenous women. She's a survivor of the 60s Scoop, mm-hmm. and also has experienced domestic violence. We ended the podcast series with Jill Dunlop. She is the Minister of Women and Children's Issues, Associate Minister, I should say. She's MPP. We've had Lauren, who is a tech executive. We had Dave Marneau, who is a family lawyer and now the executive director of the Child Witness Center. An old friend of mine, Ashley Whedon, who is a PhD candidate at Guelph, and she talked about the gendered impact of COVID. So there's kind of a bit of a podcast for everyone. And I think it really gets at how domestic violence can impact everybody, really, in one way or another.
I have queued up an episode with Chris Linklater called A Childhood Experience of Domestic Violence. Can you give us a little bit of background on that?
Yeah, well, Chris he's actually a local firefighter with Kitchener, and he grew up experiencing domestic violence, and he has just been a great advocate for us, an ambassador for us, and has made statements like, you know what, I deal with some really, really tricky things, being a first responder. However, it doesn't even amount to what it was like experiencing domestic violence as a child. And him as a young male and seeing his mom going through domestic violence and how he felt, and it's quite a powerful episode with Chris.
Let's have a listen to a few minutes of that. This is from the She Is Your Neighbor podcast by the Women's Crisis Center, Crisis Services of Waterloo Region. This is Chris Linklater. The episode is called A Childhood Experience with Domestic Violence.
Welcome to She Is Your Neighbor, a show where we discuss the realities and complexities of domestic violence. This podcast is brought to you by Women's Crisis Services of Waterloo Region, a charitable organization in Ontario, Canada. I'm your host, Jenna Main. Join me as we talk to different people each week to learn how domestic violence impacts people from all walks of life. She is your neighbor, and we all have a role to play in ending domestic violence. This episode is called A Childhood Experience of Domestic Violence with Chris Linklater. In this episode, Chris tells us his story and shares what it was like to grow up in a home with domestic violence. He talks about how he stayed in a women's shelter as a child, and he also talks about where he is now in his life. He shares that he's a firefighter with the city of Kitchener, and that he loves his job, he loves his family, and he also loves helping those in need. Chatting with Chris was so awesome. He actually hadn't shared his story very much throughout his whole life, but he said he wanted to share it as part of this initiative to show others that it's okay to talk about and to let others who are going through a similar situation know that there's hope and that there's support. I really admired this about Chris because I know it's very difficult to share your story, especially when you haven't shared it very many times before. It takes a lot of courage and bravery to do that, but it's something that is so empowering. So I just really appreciated that from Chris, and I know you're going to love hearing from him. So let's get on with this week's episode so you can hear from Chris yourself. Hi, Chris. Thanks again for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start by sharing a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I feel I'm just a regular person like anybody else, but I'm passionate about becoming a better person, a better husband, a better father, and I'm also passionate about helping those in need, and this led to me becoming a member of the Kitchener Fire Department, where I've been for over 20 years. And I'm passionate about making those around me better, friends, family, coworkers. Where I am different than most people is I grew up in a house afflicted with domestic violence. And for some reason, I have avoided talking about it my entire life up until now. But yes, my birth father was never really in the picture, and as a child he was never in the picture, and lived in Nelson House, Manitoba, which is close to 900 kilometers north of Winnipeg. It's quite a remote First Nation reserve, and he lived Nelson House his whole life, and at age 8 he was actually taken by the RCMP and taken to a residential school another almost 1,000 kilometers away, and never returned until age 17. And we all know the ruin that residential schools have brought to many First Nations people. So I believe that my father was probably heavily damaged from the residential school system. And, you know, I get it, why he wasn't involved and didn't want to leave his First Nation. And I'm only speculating. But yeah, just my own father was never involved with me as a child. So it was just my mom and I for the longest time. And when I was around, I want to say 6 or 7, my mother had met a young man who was very kind-hearted. He worked at an outreach center that helped First Nations prisoners rotate back into the world, when they were being newly released prisoners. And which is a very noble job. And my mother was a school teacher for many First Nation schools. And so they both had a common goal. And things progressed really quickly, and everything was going quite well. But at this time, I've never had any male role models in my life as a young child. So when you're a child and you don't know what normal is, the normal is the situation that you're in. And And so everything that was happening to me was just normal. Things did get violent. And thinking back, it was just completely terrifying as a kid to be in these situations. Waking up to my mom screaming, seeing my mom being thrown across the room, kicked, punched, seeing my mom's face bleeding, like a cut from the lip, or and those are the things that many kids, not just myself, are faced with on a regular basis, and it's nothing short of terrifying. But the episode that led to my mom and I ending up at a women's shelter is my stepfather and my mom were in an argument, and you can always feel if things are going to get violent. It was one of those days, and I remember my mom yelling for me to get into the car, and I did. I ran to the car, and I don't remember how she made her way to the car, but she made her way into the car. She got in, locked the doors, and she had the keys with her. And I remember my stepfather running out, and he ran to the driver's side door and was demanding my mom open the door. And so at this time, we're actually parked in our driveway facing our house. So normally we just back up onto the road and drive away. But my mom had started the car, and my stepfather turned around and he picked up a rock. And the rock was the size of, I want to say a lunchbox, but it wasn't quite that big. But that's, for some reason, that always jumps in my mind, is it was a larger rock. And like I said, we're parked in the driveway, so normally we'd back out. But as soon as my mom saw that rock, she actually drove it, put it in drive, and started driving towards our backyard. And, and at that time, I didn't know his intentions with the rock. Of course, I'm terrified. And, like I said, she gunned it, and she put it in drive and started driving towards our backyard. Now, this part I actually don't remember, but I do know that he did throw that rock through our back window. And I'm not sure if I had fainted because of the stress or if I had been knocked out a little bit, but the rock ended up going through the window. It struck the headrest of the seat I was sitting in, and it bounced up to the roof and then back down and hit me in the head. And so when I came to, my mom was actually driving in our neighbor's backyard towards their driveway and then onto the road. And that's when we found out. I reached back. I was bleeding. And when I think back about it, I could have been killed. My mom could have been killed. Like, it was just a dangerous situation. And this is what domestic violence looks like.
That's Chris Linklater recounting his experiences from childhood in A Childhood Experience of Domestic Violence on the She Is Your Neighbor podcast from the Women's Crisis Services of Waterloo Region. I'm a little choked up there. That sounds horrible. Is that typical of what people experience in domestic violence?
Well, like I had said earlier, every story is different. But, you know, it's definitely, it can happen. And, it's very intense. And to think that he was just a young child and had to experience it. But this is what it can look like. Chris now is, he's a firefighter. He's a dad. He's a partner. He's doing really, really well. That's the good news. Unfortunately, not every situation works out to be that. But Chris is just, and he was so gracious in sharing his story. It it takes a lot of courage. But, you know, and we were even a little apprehensive because he hadn't shared it a whole lot. And I know, you know, after I listened to it, I was sending him messages, kind of checking in with him, because you don't want to kind of unravel all that, any of those wounds. But it was really important for him, and he takes it very seriously around raising awareness. And you know what? The sharing of his story, I think, will help a lot of people, and that's exactly why he wanted to do it.
Yeah. We're out of time, Jen. You're going to have to come back because I don't think we're finished yet.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah. How do people get a hold of Women's Crisis Center? First of all,
yep.
People who need assistance immediately,
mm-hmm.
call the helpline, 519-742-5894 in Kitchener, 519-653-2422 in Cambridge, or go to the website, wcswr.org, and get more information there.
Okay.
Thank you, Jen, for being on.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Okay, take care.
Yep. Bye, Jen.
Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to CKMS Community Connections. My name is Bob Jonkman. CKMS Community Connections is a production of Radio Waterloo, sponsored by Radio Waterloo. Executive producer is Jennifer Strong. Associate producers are Jeff Steger, Dylan Bravener, and Jordan Dorans, who you can hear on Saturdays from 1 o'clock till 2. My name is Bob Jonkman. See you next week.